Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. Today, I'll be speaking with Professor Darcy Harris, who works at the King's University College, Western University in London, Ontario. She's currently in the Department of Thanatology, working with grief and loss, bereavement, non-death-related grief and loss, and compassion-based approaches to working in care settings. Darcy, along with Andy Ho, recently edited the book Compassion-Based Approaches to Working with Grief and Loss. I was lucky enough to have a couple of chapters in that book. Darcy's doing some wonderful work, and I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing her speak about it all. And so I bring you Professor Darcy Harris. That's all good. Yeah, well, thank you so much for being willing to speak with me and all the way from London, Ontario, I think is where you're at. And I was looking at the map and it's kind of tucked in there amongst the Great Lakes, I guess. It's sort of this little interesting peninsula almost kind of thing, but on the eastern side of Canada.
A lot of wet weather, so we get a lot of dreary gray weather and a lot of snow. When the wind goes over the Lake Huron, we get the lake effect snow as well, so
Well, the pictures look very green and beautiful, so it must maybe it lushes up, you know, kind of come spring and summer.
In the summer, it certainly does. Absolutely.
And though we haven't met sort of face-to-face, as we were saying a moment ago, I was lucky enough to be a part of your most recent book, which is Compassion-Based Approaches to Grief and Loss. And I'll put a link to that, of course, in the description for people who might be interested. But welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
So excited to have you ask me. Thank you so much. This is great. Yeah.
It's good. Good. Excellent. Well, I guess firstly, I wondered whether you could just tell us a little bit about you, about your story, perhaps, but especially to some of the work that you're doing in the area of grief and loss and bereavement and perhaps some of the compassion focused approaches in different care settings. So yeah, tell us a little bit about you.
That's a very big, broad, sweeping question.
I know.
I'm originally actually from Florida. And so how most people go from Canada down to Florida, I did it the opposite direction. But when I was in Florida, my original degree was in nursing. And so I was originally working in oncology, cancer care, and hospice care. And I did that for many years. And when I moved to Canada, the type of nursing that I practiced and the way it was practiced, because the two healthcare systems were so different, my license was reciprocated, but the way of practicing was really different. And I always needed to have a close relationship with my patients and families, and that wasn't happening. So then I did my master's in counseling psychology, thinking I would just, you know, go into private practice, which is what I did, specialized in grief and bereavement, because it was kind of an extension of what I'd done as a nurse. And in the process, also, I became aware of a program in London where I had moved in thanatology, which is the study of death and loss, and thought it would be a nice way for me to network with people local and to get a sense of the healthcare system being just kind of more understand, you know, some of the cultural differences in the healthcare system. So I went into that program. And when I graduated, the coordinator of that program asked if I would teach in the program. So I was practicing. I had a clinical practice. I was working at a downtown counseling center. I had my private practice and I was teaching. And I surprisingly enjoyed the teaching. I didn't think I would really like it, but I really enjoyed it. And a lot of people just very keen to know how to support people going through really difficult times in their lives. And then what happened was the person who kind of recruited me, my mentor and the coordinator, got very ill and had to retire quickly. And so I was asked to step into his position because I was the only person they knew of that understood the program in any kind of background. And then the year after that, they asked me to come on board full time. And I had to make a decision of what am I going to do? And at the time, I had a 2-year-old. And many of us know that doing therapy work, you're doing a lot of evenings and weekends to accommodate people's work schedules. And that wasn't necessarily working with having a baby, a young child. And so I thought, well, this will be a nice, more stable place for me to go. And I ended up just really enjoying what I was doing. And I got to grow the program and started really networking with other disciplines at the university that's here in terms of nursing or medicine, social work. We have a theology program. So I began networking with people from all walks of life to talk about how do you best support people going through these really difficult times. So I still do have a private clinical practice. I don't think I'd ever want to give that up because I love working with clients. So I'm careful because I have to watch my time and I can't clone myself. But I'm blessed because I get to do things that I really love to do, and I get paid for it, which is really good. It's nice. But so my primary work has been working now with people who are experiencing different types of loss and grief. My doctoral work, I was working in an infertility clinic, and I interviewed women that were going through infertility in that process. And that's when I began to listen hard, and they were saying the language of grief. They were talking about grief and loss, and you know, it was really grief that they were expressing. But I'm thinking, you know, what died here? You know, where's the loss of the attachment figure? Because that's what I had always been taught to believe, that grief was the result of the breaking of an attachment bond when someone dies. But this was undeniably grief. And that became the work I did in my doctoral dissertation, was exploring, you know, what is grief really? And it's interesting because there was research that came out in mid-1990s that acknowledged that for a lot of people, when you lose a loved one, you know, they may die, but the relationship still continues, that the bond really doesn't break, that, you know, you think about someone that you've loved or that you've been close to and they die, you can sometimes feel their presence. Or you might have a dream and feel like you're interacting with them, or you might chuckle at, you know, that this is something they would say in response here, but there's still a continuing relationship, even though it's intangible. And that was revolutionary for the field to recognize that people have what we call continuing bonds. And that made me still question further, okay, so what is grief then? And so what I started looking at was really, when people were grieving, it was because something that they had expected or hoped for or dreamed about was shattered, you know, by an event or by something untoward happening or something unplanned. And that's what seemed to be triggering grief. And of course, the death of a loved one, or someone that's close to you, is going to do that as well. But it opened up, you know, the door to really acknowledge, you know, we grieve when a marriage dies. We grieve when we're laid off from a job. We grieve when a friendship, you know, ends abruptly, or, you know, we grieve when we have a diagnosis that we know we'll have to accommodate for the rest of our lives. And why I think it's important is that grief is not a clinical entity. It's not depression. It's not something you treat. It's the human condition, you know, it's life. And so to normalize the reaction to these losses, to these experiences as something that's painful, but something that's also normal and human. And that's why I think it's really important to recognize grief for what it is and not try to label it as something else. Because you label it something else, you start looking at how you're going to treat it. And you don't treat the human condition. You live the human condition. Does that make sense?
Live the human condition. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of, I mean, that's profound, isn't it? When you think about that, I mean, it's a very important reframe. I was really interested to hear what you said, because when I was sort of reading your bio and things like that, it really struck me that there are sort of many contexts, I suppose, in which grief can occur. Made me think that maybe grief in each of those contexts might be different too. But I suppose what I'm hearing you say now is it's more along the lines of the context may vary, but the central theme is something around the loss of something wanted or cherished or loved, or and it might be a person certainly or some other attachment figure, but it also might be an expectation or a dream or a role in life, or you know, there could be a whole range of, but there's something about grief itself that is actually kind of consistent across those different areas or contexts.
And I mean, grief can manifest in myriad ways, but it's important, I think, to recognize that, you know, grief is you know, the response to what I call the shattering of our assumptive world, you know, the shattering of what we hoped for, dreamt for, expected. And I think it's these intangible losses, the loss of innocence or the loss of faith, or the loss of our hopes and dreams, because you look normal, you look okay on the outside, but on the inside, you really are struggling and something inside you has died, you know, you feel that. And to really be able to have words for that, for clients especially, but for us going through these experiences, having the words to describe this experience can be really empowering and validating, because a lot of these losses get swept under because, oh, it's just, I'll just get over it, or it's not that big of a deal. And nobody else can decide if it's a big deal or not. If it's a big deal to you, it's a big deal, right? You know, it's a subjectively appraised experience. And I think that's where we get into trouble, because socially we have a hierarchy. Tony Walter will talk about this, a hierarchy of losses, that, you know, the worst case scenario is you lose a child, and the next worst scenario is you lose a spouse. What about if you lose your beloved dog? You know, and that dog meant to you more than anything else in the world, but well, that's still going to be on the lower part of the hierarchy. Well, what if you lose your job? You can get another job. You know, so there's hierarchies in terms of how social support is offered and how the loss is recognized that have nothing to do with how you're experiencing that loss yourself. You know, so it's trying to give people the ability to just acknowledge their experience and validate, you know, their actual subjective experience, so that they can then kind of decide what it is that they need in that experience, instead of trying to shove it under the carpet because there's, you know, they're feeling like, you know, people are thinking they're overreacting, or, you know, just get over it kind of. That doesn't work very well. You know, grief doesn't just go away.
Yeah, no, there's so much that you say. I've got so many thoughts and questions for you, but yeah, I think the conversation between perhaps the therapist maybe and the person grieving, you know, that's a real opportunity to put these things into words and to kind of validate that experience. But that social, that sort of hierarchical idea of grief and almost what's worthy grief and what isn't as worthy almost. And I can sort of see that's where the links to self-consciousness or shame really start to enter the conversation too.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the reasons I was really drawn to looking at, you know, compassion-based approaches, because so much of what I do in my practice with clients is to debunk some of these social messages that don't serve us well. They're not based on any kind of reality of what people live. They're based on social messaging that has to do with capitalism and, you know, being productive at all costs and the stiff upper lip. And those are things that have been passed down intergenerationally to us, but they don't have anything to do with our actual lived experience of what we're going through. So we tend to self, what I call disenfranchise. We self-disenfranchise, and that's that shame piece that comes in. And try to, you know, hide it because it's embarrassing. We shouldn't be feeling that much. Instead of being able to say, I am feeling this much, and I really am hurting right now. Instead of feeling, you know, shameful that I am hurting right now. I give the example. I'm very attached to my animals, and this was several years ago. I had a beloved cat that died suddenly, and I was devastated. And I called her Kitty of my heart. You know, she was just constantly my companion. You know, she would sit on top of me. She slept with me. She was just, you know, she could read my mind, you know, and she died suddenly, and I was just devastated. And I was really emotionally just overwrought. And I consciously chose not to go into my office that next day, but I knew I had to pick up my mail. So I thought, well, if I go after 6 p.m., the likelihood of me running into somebody is lower. And so I'll just sneak in real quick, grab my mail and go back. And if all I'm getting my mail, turn around, smack into my dean. It's like your boss, you know. My face is all red, puffy. And he says, "Are you okay?" So I said, "Oh no." I said, "I just lost this beloved cat and it's just been hard. And I'm waiting for him to say, oh, you know." Then he started telling me about his dog that had died a month before and how hard it was. And he almost had tears in his eyes. And I was so grateful that at least the person I ran into, you know, understood, because there's so many people that in not knowing how to respond, they really try to make it better or dismiss it. And in that process, they really suffocate your grief. I was grateful, but I was very aware that consciously I was not letting myself go into public because I didn't want to have to explain and have it, you know, have the shame that, you know, it's just a cat. Because to me, it was much more than just a cat. It was my companion. So that's an example. And even though it was a death loss, it's an example of that.
And I find it, I mean, I've had many people feel that way when they come, I guess, to see me, and they've had a loss, like a lost animal, and they feel like they shouldn't be grieving this much. It was just an animal, and or something like that, and people will expect something more of them, and so on. And yet, it's also interesting that when you do share it with others, especially others that you kind of can trust or whatever, they'll say, "Oh no, you know, like yes, that is important." And so, some of that social feeling is kind of within us too, isn't it? And it's a social fear, really, that people will disapprove of us for that reason, which of course is where shame often resides.
That's
is
right.
that concern about how we'll be held in the minds of others, even if were they actually to know about it, they might have experienced something very similar, or they might actually understand. I mean, just full disclosure, I lost my Bruno, the chocolate Labrador, just in October, and it was brutal and harrowing and very upsetting. I mean, I noticed myself saying to people, "Oh yeah, no, it's okay," you know, what we're trying to, you just can't, just sort of. But of course, you know, and actually, the interesting thing, we might come back to this later because I was curious about this, but the interesting thing with Bruno was that he has long been, through imagery, my compassionate friend. And now he remains my compassionate friend, but it's tricky because there's this sort of little grief piece as well.
That's
so
right.
I I wouldn't mind sort of exploring that as you know, a bit later today. But I did want to ask you a little question, because when you said you were doing your doctoral thesis and you were speaking to those people with infertility,
right,
what was it in what they were saying or doing or experiencing that made you feel, yes, this is also grief? Are there things that you sort of really observed there, or is there something that kind of defines grief in that sense?
They were using the word grief. You know, they were talking about, you know, the loss of, you know, the loss of my hopes, or the loss of, you know, never being a mom. And always wanting to be a mom, and you know, now that's all lost to me. And so these were transcripts that I had to, transcribe. So I went through, and it was just striking to me, the language they were using was they were using the terms grief and loss, and that they were in mourning. They were using, you know, these words. In research, I didn't necessarily do a lot of reflecting back because I was really wanting to hear from them. But I did find in my practice, you know, I had some couples going through infertility, and when I would validate back, "This is a huge loss for you," they would just, yes, you know, they would just say, "That's it. That's what it is. This is, you know, the grief of the baby I'll never hold in my arms, you know, and the loss of the child of my dreams." And so it was very apparent. I mean, it wasn't something I had to really delve into and do a lot of analyzing. It was in my face. And so that's what made me start questioning what is grief. And I'll often use the image of a window pane that's been shattered, you know, shattered glass, that, you know, that's a loss, because you can't ever return a pane of shattered glass to where it looks the same again. You can glue the pieces back together, but it'll never look the same, and that's a loss. Something has happened that you will never be able to go back to the way you were before in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, for these women going through infertility treatment, they will never be able to naively think that I'm just going to have kids and this is going to be how life will unfold. And I can picture myself being, you know, the mom at school, and this, you know, all of that, the cascade of all the different imagery and plans that they had based upon this, I'm going to be a mom. All of that just got wiped away from them. So it made me question, you know, this is grief, but what is grief really? And so you can really look at that. And I call it the shattered assumptive world, that it's when
yes.
the things we see, the things that make us feel safe in our lives, the way we see ourselves, the way how we feel safe with the people around us, or how we find safety, and, you know, our sense of how things work, you know, the sense of justice and fairness, and if A, then B, you know, if I work hard, I'll be rewarded, you know, that kind of stuff. It's when those things get really shattered that you can't just integrate something. It's just too big. I think that's what triggers grief. That's what really triggers the grief response. And it's not a cognitive piece. It's much deeper than that. It's voiced sometimes, you know, as a sense-making thing, but it's really about a loss of meaning and a loss of purpose and a loss of hope that comes in there. So to me, that's the trigger, you know, for grief and in different ways and forms. So to me, in working with clients, as I'm listening for these things, and I'll just kind of validate back to them the places where I hear that their assumptive world has been profoundly affected and broken, and wait to hear, am I getting this right? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, yeah, I'm getting it right. So I'm not listening for, you know, what I'm going to do with interventions. I'm listening for their language and listening for intuitively their sense of loss and where it's focused, so that I can, first of all, just journey alongside them in that, because that's really the whole thing with grief, is I want to companion, you know, people in this grief. I can't take it away. There's nothing I'm going to say that's going to make it better. You know, I can't suggest to go get a prescription that's going to, you know, if anything, medication often makes this worse. So, you know, I have to find a way of being with suffering so that I can, you know, bear witness to suffering without needing to turn away. And that was one of the things about looking at compassion-focused therapy, is that turning toward suffering and being able to be fully present to the suffering without rushing in and trying to rescue and fix, because you can't anyway. And that takes a pretty strong practice, I think, for therapists to be able to do that, and to be that. And that's a real crux point in terms of working with people who are grieving.
Yes, the grief is deeply subjective in a way. It's sort of felt at a very deep and powerful level, and it's not just sort of kind of more objective, obvious things that we can kind of point to, but rather it comes out in the kind of the psycholinguistics of grief, almost the things people say, and certain words or kind of, you know, describing a certain experience, and the person, the helper, the person trying to be there for them, is kind of listening for that, really. It's mm-hmm. quite a you know, a sophisticated type of listening, isn't it, really, to really be able to tune in to those, to the language of grief. And sometimes the person, well, it'll be coming and they'll be using words like, you know, loss and mourning and so on. But every now and then it might be in the listener's reflection, where the listener says, it, you know, it really, it's a kind of a grieving, you know, it might even be like that. And the person, you know, perhaps it resonates then, and they kind of feel like you've got it, and that you understand. So,
yeah, and that's, you know, you'll really say, there's a lot of loss here, and I can see the losses, and you know, is this what it feels like for you? And listen to see, are you on track? But to also not have a plan in place in terms of I'm going to make this better, because you can't. I mean, you know, and there are things you can do as a therapist, I think, down the road, but you have to first do that joining part with the, you know, the companioning part, and recognize this is really just what it is. This is grief, and we all are going to, you know, experience. It's a common piece that we both share, and in different ways, but we both share this experience.
Yes, it's an initial engagement, a period where the person feels heard and understood and validated and kind of safe, I guess, to experience this thing with the therapist, I guess, as a kind of a companion to that. And mm-hmm. There are some tricky urges, aren't they, for the therapist? One is to find it very difficult themselves, and therefore the urge to turn away from it, or trying to sort of step in and fix it, because I mean, maybe that's coming from a similar feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it comes from a good place, but it's an interference, really. So to be able to, I have, when I work with my students on this, I make them sit on their hands. they listen to each other. I make them sit on their hands and not be able to say. They have to just listen. It's so hard, because that's not how we're used to being. And they feel the pressure that they have to do something. And yeah, down the road, you'll become more engaged as you know this person and they know you. But, you know, you've got to first start with this journeying alongside and joining with them in that. If you don't have the ability to tolerate intensity and tolerate suffering, this is not going to be an area that's going to flow for you. So that's where the compassion, you know, piece really does come in. And I'll segue into this, because as I started looking at the non-death losses more, I worked for a little while in neurology, kind of a stint I did for 6 months or so. And what I noticed was that in the neurological clinic, the patients that had the chronic long-term degenerative diseases, the chronic pain syndromes, the migraines that weren't responding, the back pain that wasn't doing well, that the staff would kind of tend to put their phone calls to the end of the day. They'd sort of put them off. And what it really boiled down to was that they felt they were failing because they couldn't fix these people. They couldn't make them better. And so the only paradigm they had in terms of their medical training was to make people better. And if you're not making people better, you're not getting it right. Your diagnostic, you know, approach is wrong, or your treatment modality is incorrect. There was never an understanding that there's sometimes pain you are not going to be able to relieve. There was no paradigm for that. So what was happening is that patients and families would start feeling abandoned, you know, by their healthcare practitioners. Healthcare practitioners would feel like they were kind of failing with this person. And it was just a really bad scenario all around. And so as I started looking at things like chronic sorrow and non-finite losses, or losses that go on for really, you live with them for the rest of your life, you see this happen to people and their supports as well. The friends stop coming around. The family members start, you know, calling less. And you have to advocate more when you're calling for help with your care providers. You know, you have to be more aggressive about, you know, getting what you need. And so it becomes a scenario where people start feeling exhausted, the supports get exhausted, and the people with these experiences, and often their caregivers, feel abandoned. And I was looking to find a way to sustainably work alongside people who are in these, you know, chronic pain, difficult situations. And I attended, it was actually a bereavement conference I attended in Hong Kong, but there was a person who presented there. She had done the CMF training. She had done the Compassionate Mind training. She's actually based in Toronto, but she's presenting in Hong Kong. And for the first time she presented, she laid it out. She talked about, you know, Singer and Klimke's research, and looking at the people who'd done compassion training and how that showed in the functional MRIs in terms of seeing pain, images that were painful and distressing. But what was lighting up was their reward center versus those who were highly empathic, but hadn't done the compassion training. Their distress centers were lighting up, and it just made so much sense to me. And it was one of those, I sat there and I thought, I want me some of that. And because it made so much sense, you know.
Yeah, I'll have what she's having, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly. I'll take two of those, please. And I had the opportunity to go to the Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and do their compassion training program. It's called Being with Dying, but they incorporate in a compassion training program into that. And it was really transformative. It was just an amazing experience. And I began looking at the work I was wanting to do very differently. I already had my own practice, my own spiritual practice, my own mindfulness practice, my body practices. But this was a missing link for me in terms of focusing on intention and motivation rather than focusing on a certain outcome. I love the, we all talk about NATO, you know, it's not the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it's not attached to outcome. And I love that acronym because I don't have to sit here and expect a certain thing to happen. I come here to show up and to be willing to step in or to step back, but to consider in any situation how I can be in the situation versus what I'm going to do. It takes the pressure off. You know, it's not on me to fix what can't be fixed. It's on me to be fully present to what's in front of me at any given moment. And that's really freeing, I think, in this work.
Yes, the Paul Gilbert's definition often comes to mind, but it comes to mind here that, you know, compassion is the sensitivity to suffering in self and others with a commitment to try. You know, it doesn't give any guarantees to actually alleviating or preventing all suffering. It's just in the intention to sort of
it's
be
the
there
intention.
And be with. And I sort of felt like there was almost a connector there with clinicians who have assumptions themselves, I guess. And those assumptions get kind of shattered too when they're, you know, working in certain areas. And there's almost a grieving for clinicians, you know, when they feel like they haven't been able to help or that, you know, that assumption hasn't been met. But yes, disentangling empathy and compassion, that empathy can be the part of all of that that maybe leads to the burnout or whatever, whereas compassion, you know, especially when we really kind of connect with that and get our head around it, it's a more self-sustaining kind of approach, still about being helpful and alleviating and preventing suffering, but also with the wisdom about, you know, what changes can happen or that things might take time, sort of thing.
Yeah, the wisdom and I call it the discernment, you know, that
discernment.
you really cultivate that you recognize that even as I step into this situation with this person who's really in a lot of pain, I may or may not be able to relieve their pain. It doesn't mean I can't make a difference by being fully present to that person and, you know, journey alongside them, even in the midst of the pain I can't relieve. And that really does take some staying power, I think, to do that. I take issue. I hear a lot of people talk about, well, compassion differs from empathy because you do something. It's about, you know, being willing to do something, willing to help, to step forward. I'm thinking, no, you know, to me, you think about compassion is based upon your motivation and intention to want to relieve suffering with the wisdom to know that you're not going to be able to relieve all of that suffering. And it's that piece, I think, that frees us to step forward freely and to not be caught up in outcomes and expectations. I think being able to be freed from that. I've heard so many clinicians say that they don't like working with people who are grieving. They don't feel like they can do anything. They feel helpless. And I'm thinking it's fertile ground for practice. You know, it's really grounding for accepting the human condition, accepting that this is life, and being able to walk into that, the unrealistic expectation that we can, you know, make it better, or we can say something magical that all of a sudden the person's going to look up and say, I feel so much better now. That's in movies. That doesn't happen in reality. I mean, people may feel better because you're journeying with them and they feel for the first time in ages that you really care, and they sense that. And that's healing, I think, in and of itself. But at the same point in time, once again, I wanted something that would give me the ability to step forward and be able to sustain my stepping forward into these very difficult situations. And it has been wonderful in terms of my practice. It's been wonderful in terms of my teaching as well. I mean, I'm part of the Compassion Higher Education, a special interest group. And I love that. I love the questions that we ask. And how can I, as someone who's in higher education, foster a classroom that exudes a sense of, it's okay, you're safe here, you can discuss this. And at the same time, I have to be giving them grades and I have to be marking. So I have to balance, that. But what does it look like in terms of teaching compassionately? So that way I don't burn out in a system that's focused on something that to me is extraneous to what I really want to do in terms of teaching and instilling, certain things in my learners. You're getting a whole earful that you hadn't planned. It's a whole
wonderful
thing, right?
Wonderful stuff. I mean, it's compassion allows for us to maintain the kind of the stepping up and the staying present and the bearing witness and, all of those elements that are the companionable part, I guess, rather than let's fix this kind of part.
Yes.
What would be, like, if you think about a compassion-based approach, when sort of literally perhaps working with someone, I mean, what would that kind of look like, or what are the sort of the elements that you might work through?
Yeah, so I talk about compassion and grief therapy having two prongs, and it's
okay.
probably true in all therapy, but the first one is the compassionate stance of the therapist, and this is the therapist's sense of compassion, their ability to be open with flows of compassion themselves. And to be able to feel grounded in that's the one prong. And then the other prong is then, the therapist then working, with the client and integrating some of the principles of compassion and compassion-based approaches. And I do primarily use CFT because it's really the only compassion-based approach that's been made into an actual therapy per se, but I've trained in other areas with compassion, like the Upaya Zen Center, and there's some really lovely, things there as well. But the aside from being able to step into, the suffering, I think I work first with the person actually kind of experiencing a sense of compassion in the session, and I call it compassionate reframing. And this is something that, if you've seen any of my work. So here, some of the things I hear a lot, I just need to get over this and get on with my life. I'm wallowing in this self-pity. And, the reframe, I'm not trying to get into an argument. I'll just say, yeah, but it really seems to make sense that you need this time because this has been a huge loss. It's going to have an impact on you. It's almost like you're advocating for the person with the person so they can understand a way of being with themselves that allows. I do a lot of that. And I do a lot of debunking of social norms and messaging that have no business, being applied to grief in terms of timelines, how grief should look, whether or not your grief is valid. It's, that's a lot of the reframing I do. So that's really about modeling a way of being with themselves with compassion. Then I do go into some of the imagery, and I also use some energy work. So the imagery you brought up about Bruno, I think it's really funny.
Yeah.
I'm careful, that I almost always will use if my client has an animal, I will ask them about their animal, and I will first go to that animal being their compassionate being. And especially a lot of my clients now I'm meeting with them virtually. They're at home. Almost all of them, their dog or cat or their animal's right there with them. And some of them will turn the camera and show me their dog, and I'll say, look at the way your dog is looking at you. What does that feel like? And, take that in and close your eyes. And can you feel their fur? Can you feel, just that presence with you? And that gives them, you know, a sense of groundedness and a sense of compassion. They're being reflected back through this these unconditional love of their animal, because that's what animals give to us. It's a safe place to start. I laugh because I had one client, I was doing this, and she had a beautiful big poodle that was right there with her. And I, you know, I said, can you, you know, close your eyes and think of her? And then she looked up and she goes, she's going to die one day.
Yeah.
And I said, you had a lot of loss, and so you're going to go there.
Beautiful.
But for now, she's right with you, you know. And so she could had to acknowledge that that was a fear for her. But at the same time, let's not move away from in the here and now. She's right here with you right now. So let's take that moment, and she could then engage back. That's where I start, because if you ask them to picture a compassionate being, sometimes they will go to the person that died, or that can get tricky, because sometimes the relationship wasn't always a good one, or it brings up so much grief that they can't be comforted by the presence of that person. So I almost always go to, if they have an animal, I start there. That's one of the imagery. Another place I go to is body grounding. I find soothing rhythm breathing, and it might just be me, I find it harder to do virtually with people without just breathing heavily, you know. So I tend to do more of an energy work. So I have people rub their hands together and get, you know, that you feel the energy here. And then I ask them, when they feel the energy, to put it right over their heart space and to breathe into that. And it just gives them a sense of presence of being in the here and now. It's a self-soothing. So I think with compassion-focused therapy, what's helpful is the acknowledgement of the biophysiological relationships that I'm not a talking head, you know, and my heart is definitely involved and opened and broken open by this grief. And there are things that we can work with in compassion-focused therapy that really do allow people to sit with that grief and to let it do the work it needs to do. So I have one client, it's funny, she agreed to let me videotape a session with her. And partway through the session, she just went really deeply into her grief, and immediately she puts her hands on her chest and she breathes, and she's patting herself as she's doing it, because this is what we've done. And she stayed with that grief, you know, for a good 5-6 minutes, and then came back and she said, oh, I needed that, you know, and yet I did nothing. I simply just stayed with her, because she knew now how to soothe herself. And that was a way that helped her to do that. So I think I'm always looking for different things that my clients, and of course, everybody is so different, you know, so I'm always looking for what might be useful, and kind of careful around that as well.
Yeah, I love a lot, all of that. I mean, the you started with the compassionate stance, which I was going to ask you about, because in some ways, to be someone who works with grief, we're wanting to have those three flows kind of, you know, cultivated and sort of in operation for ourselves as much as anything. The compassionate conversations and reframing and even the debunking of social norms and messaging. Bringing it back to the body and some of the body grounding and the almost more somatic kinds of ways in and having that one eye on the bias, psychophysiological kind of aspects to it all. And the imagery work, being caring but careful, finding a safe place to start. And actually it's interesting, because even when I'm working with someone where it's not really about grief per se, something like the compassionate friend or compassionate other exercise can actually just bring them to a person that they have lost. And I like that notion of just a little bit of guidance, maybe, you know, as well, or at least some conversation in the lead up, just to kind of see where they might take an exercise like that, because the grief can sneak in a little bit. And the one that you said too, is which is interesting, is I suppose it's almost like anticipated grief, you know, when and this is kind of a hard one when it comes to opening ourselves up to receiving compassion, even from our beautiful poodle, is when we feel open to receiving compassion, the little thought comes up that being will potentially one day themselves be gone. And so there's a lot to it, isn't there? And it's kind of, yeah. You know, a lot to kind of navigate and very powerful feelings of attachment versus, you know, fears and so on.
Yeah, it's one of those that I think we're very well versed in impermanence. You know, it's like you just got a crash course on impermanence that you didn't ask for. And you realize everything now that you value or that you love or that defines you is impermanent. And so that's a really scary place to be, you know. And of course, that's something we know is a fundamental aspect of, you know, practice is impermanence, but to have it be thrown at you in such a way that it's shocking. You know, that's a big piece. And so, you know, I could go down the road with her of, yes, you are going to lose, you know, your dog or your dog's going to lose you. And I thought, let's stay in the here and now. So that's why I grounded her and said, but right here and right now, she's here. And you can be in her presence. It was one of those, you could see because the shoe had dropped and another shoe and she just had a cascade.
Yes.
And she was so raw and tender from all of that. She just, I think in her mind, she can't afford another loss. It's just, you know, she just doesn't know where she could incorporate. She just couldn't do that. And that's where she's going to, it was a protective, you know, thing that came to her.
Yeah.
Whoa, don't, you know, but that's not how she really wanted to live either, but she didn't know how to not be that.
I mean, it's sort of threat system activating, isn't it? Not to be oversimplifying,
absolutely.
I suppose, but yeah, the protection mechanism kicks in, and we
that's
want
right.
to protect ourselves from further loss.
I don't want to go through this ever again.
Yeah,
I had one client that she'd been through. Both parents had died, and she finally found someone to share her life with. They wanted children. She went through infertility and they were in their second year going through fertility treatment. He got diagnosed with ALS. It's just, and you know, she came in my office and her first words were, I don't want to do feeling vocabulary. Somebody had given her feeling vocabulary because she was having a hard time talking about feelings. She's, I don't want to do this.
Right.
I'm not doing this. And I said, I got you. We're not doing that. It's okay.
Yes.
But you know, for her, she couldn't come up for air before she would just get smashed back down again. And these were no small losses. These were everything that had meaning in her life. And really her biggest question was, do I still want to be here without all of this? You know, and she really had to grasp with herself, do I want to stay? And this was the only place I didn't try to talk her out of it because, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to anyway. She needed a safe place to explore. Do I want to stay or not? And I let her just explore it. And I let her feel what she wanted to and, you know, go back and forth with what she needed to. And I remember her saying, I knew better. I knew better than to fall in love. I knew better than to risk this. And here the universe did this to me. And this is the rest of my life now. And it was interesting because 2 years later, she called me and she had met someone and was remarrying. And she said, I'm not going to let you say I told you so. I'll say it. You know, you believed in this for me. And she said, but if you hadn't believed in this for me, I wouldn't be here. You know, so it's, but you can't rush into rescue, you know, people. You have to sit with them in it and let them figure it out, but not do it necessarily all alone.
We have this very tough, confronting reality of life, don't we? That we're, you know, at most sort of 25,000 to 30,000 days of life or something, and we are born and then we grow up and age and decay and die, and it's a very painful.
It sounds really dire, Sam.
Yeah, not wanting to bring it all down, bring us down. But I guess I was reflecting back on your original comment, which was that grief and loss is life, or it's a part of life, you know, in a sense. And we're not trying to fix a disorder or something, but we're just trying to be there with a person as they experience their particular life, I suppose.
And if you think about, compassion is something that has been, cultivated as we formed kinship groups and we began to share tasks and affiliate more. Grief also is really, I think, the assumptive role is part of our attachment system. I think you can't separate these two things. It's like these two aspects of humanity evolved, alongside each other. And it makes sense that, the ability to relate, the ability to want to affiliate, the ability to want to share the burden comes along at a time when people also recognize the finitude of life and the impermanence that happens. These two things go really just like this together so well. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, I've seen all sorts of different kinds of therapies for grief and loss, and I've trained in several of them. And it's not you don't use your toolkit. There are certain things that you just use in your toolkit because you're comfortable and you know how to work with them and stuff. But I think the compassion piece is the undercurrent. It's your foundation. It's always where you can go back to and find home base. And it's also where you can help your clients to come to a place of being with their own pain so that they're not flooded and overwhelmed. They have a way of soothing and being with it, and they develop capacity and deepen as a result of what they've gone through.
Hmm.
So I really see how this has just been a beautiful way of putting things together, and I see it working so well with my clients. I see it work with my own process too.
Hmm.
I just this week I'm teaching a class for at the university on therapeutic modalities in grief and loss, and this week was when we talk about compassion focused therapy, and the light bulbs are going off. And I was just before I was talking with you reading some of their reflections about CFT and what compassion is, and it's just like, oh wow, I never thought of this before. Oh my goodness, and just the light bulb going off, and it just made me smile because they got it. They understand, what the joy of this work can be as well.
But, yes, it's powerful stuff, and powerful for all concerned, isn't it? For the helper as much as the person who may be grieving. Well, Darcy, thank you very much for having a little chat. I'm sure people will be sort of intrigued to discover more of your work. So where could people find you or find your work, or what have you got coming up that might be of interest?
I am doing some work with the CMF, and I'll be doing a series of grief webinars. I think in May is probably what we're going to set up. And because I'm in North America and CMF is in England, we'll probably do it as a series of four different workshops to make sure that the time overlap is okay for both. And of course, I've got the book that just came out as well. And currently, if you go to Amazon or Routledge, the books that I've been working on, I've got a book on non-death, loss, and grief. And I'm actually working right now on a book looking at social justice and social messaging for people who are experiencing loss and grief as well.
Mm. And I think there might be soon, or is it already out, a paper on compassion-focused grief therapy?
So it's in the OBM journal, Medical Journal of Contemporary Alternative Practice Medicine. I think it's OBM, and I can't remember the whole word of it. But it was lovely because I had the ability in that one to really kind of explore more in depth and some of the newer things that have come through with CFT that I was able to integrate in terms of how you look at the three circles model and how does grief really fit in, just so you have a sense of why am I doing what I'm doing, and giving some background for that so we kind of understand, this is why I'm thinking the way I'm thinking, why I'm doing what I'm doing. And this is an approach that I could take. So that article was really already released, so it's available as well. I put a couple of things out looking at compassion and grief in different aspects. So it's been exciting. It's been exciting work.
I'll put some links to all those various bits and pieces in the description. And but that was wonderful, inspiring. Thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for a lovely conversation.
Thank you for inviting me, Stan. This was lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.